full as a $150 gun, and that's going to dramatically expand the gun market. As I said, the number of guns in the United States doubles every 25 years or so after the end of the Second World War, precisely because of that phenomenon.
And then you have the other way, it going the other way. I mean, you've got the gun violence in the United States and the U.S. involvement in international small arms trade and trafficking and refusing to sign off on being an obstacle at the U.N. to sign off on treaties that would limit small guns in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I mean, if we look back at the process in the United Nations beginning in the mid-1990s and leading all the way up to finally the signing of a completely watered down treaty in 2013, we saw the real powerful influence of the NRA there, and in particular, the NRA's kind of bulldog, John Bolton, who went to the UN in 2001 and tried to shut down every international effort that would have created any kind of substantive controls on international small arms sales.
And then very quickly, two issues. Tennessee. I mean, perhaps the trying to get rid of the two youngest black lawmakers, the Republican House Speaker and his allies in the Tennessee legislature, was about trying to prevent the push for gun control in Tennessee, which so many support, though you wouldn't know it within the legislature. And now, while they're not protecting the children, they want to protect the arms industry, a bill that's now going to Bill Lee's desk, the Tennessee governor who signed off on a gun deregulation bill in a Beretta gun factory.
Mm. Yeah. So, you know, I had heard you mention the 2005 law, the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, which already shields gun makers from liability in a number of ways. And that law was written in the wake of a wave of lawsuits against gun makers by gun control organizations, by large municipalities that sought to force the gun makers to pay for the consequences of the seemingly uncontrolled proliferation of firearms that was had ticked up dramatically in the early 1990s. In addition to the very obvious human trauma, there are, of course, economic costs to gun violence as well. And so the PCLAA or the PLCAA, the intention of that was to shield gun makers nationally. And of course, it's signed into law by the George W. Bush administration so that gun makers could not be sued for their guns working as they are designed to maim and kill human beings. What the Tennessee legislature is doing, I think, is essentially a kind of lip service to it's essentially a moot point in that there are already those protections in place. But I also think the Tennessee legislature watched what happened last year within the Remington case, when Remington, the rifle maker Remington, was settled with the Sandy Hook families for $73 million. And that's what they're trying to prevent. Gun control organizations and activists from looking for loopholes in the 2005 law, like, for instance, in the case of Sandy Hook, targeting their advertising rather than the guns themselves. And Tennessee wants to cut that off because ultimately the sanctity of gun capitalism must remain secure.
Drew McKevitt, I want to thank you so much for being with us, author of the forthcoming book, Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture and Control in Cold War America, speaking to us from Shreveport, where he's an associate professor of history at Louisiana Tech University. As we turn now to South Texas, where Elon Musk's SpaceX is claiming success after the first launch of its massive new rocket dubbed Starship. The two-stage prototype lifted off Thursday morning from SpaceX's sprawling base on Texas's Gulf Coast near the U.S. border with Mexico, becoming the largest and heaviest machine ever to fly under its own power. At least six of the rocket's 33 engines failed during flight. The vehicle self-destructed over the Gulf of Mexico about 4 minutes after liftoff. Residents of Port Isabel near the launch site reported particulates or ash rained down on their neighborhoods. The fiery end to the launch was the latest in a series of explosions around SpaceX's launch site near the lower Rio Grande Valley National Wildlife Refuge. This comes as three liquefied natural gas projects in the Rio Grande Valley were just approved by FERC, that's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Indigenous environmental and community organizers responded Thursday to the SpaceX launch and explosion and denounced the new projects. This is Christopher Basaldu.
Rio Bravo Pipeline and SpaceX, none of these companies consulted with the original people of this land, the Carrizo Crudo tribe of Texas. None of them consulted with the tribe. None of them have our consent. But yet, they still want to destroy native homelands, ancestral homelands. We never gave our consent, and they're moving forward. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, they never consulted with the tribe. They don't have our consent, and they're moving forward anyway. That's not justice. They're enabling Musk to destroy our lands and destroy this beautiful area. It needs to stop. These are all the histories of colonial genocide against Native people and Native lands.
For more, we're joined in Brownsville, Texas, by Becca Hinojosa, an environmental and community advocate with the Grassroots Collaborative, Another Gulf is Possible. She's one of the many people who spoke out against SpaceX and faced repression and persecution. Last year, police broke into her home and arrested her after she was accused of spray painting the words "gentrified" and "stop SpaceX" under a mural in downtown Brownsville. She's still fighting the charges. Becca Hinojosa, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. So, yesterday, Elon Musk declared success when his SpaceX rocket exploded. Now, actually, though he was, of course, mocked by many, what does a failure mean if your rocket explodes out of control? Scientifically, it's a chance to test different ways of trying to shoot off this rocket. But you're on the ground. If you can talk about what SpaceX means for your communities.
You know, we're tired of living under the constant threat of flammable, you know, rocket explosions because of SpaceX. You know, Elon Musk is on his quest to colonize Mars, and it's beginning. He's beginning by colonizing, you know, our community that's on the front lines of the U.S.-Mexico border, you know, that's on the front lines of the Gulf Coast, where we're dealing with layers and layers of injustices. You know, our community is opposed to SpaceX's operations. Yesterday, you know, 27 organizations from the Rio Grande Valley signed on to a letter officially opposing the rocket launch.
So talk about who controls where he does this work. And in fact, does he choose this area of Texas and the Mexico border because of the deregulation of Texas and the fact what kind of regulation does he face and what kind of consent is required, if any, of the local community?
You know, it's very clear that Elon Musk moved into our border community to take over, to colonize the region. We're clearly being exploited by a billionaire and his pet project. You know, we are a low-income community of color, and Texas has a long history of deregulation, of just rubber stamping permits and approvals for any big industry. And also give out numerous tax subsidies. You know, that's what we've seen with SpaceX. You know, he's moved into our community and, you know, turned us into a testing ground. It's at the point now where, you know, I hear a noise, my family and I, and we wonder, you know, is that SpaceX? And we come to find out that the rumble is because of a rocket launch, or I, you know, hear a huge explosion or blast from 10 miles away, and it turns out that SpaceX has done some kind of unannounced rocket testing. You know, we're constantly dealing with just the growth of SpaceX and their operations.
So, Becca, last year you were violently arrested after police broke into your home without showing you a warrant. You were detained for, what, more than a day, for 26 hours. Police took your glasses. They placed you in a cold cell after you were interrogated, charged with what, a misdemeanor, accused of spray painting these words gentrified and stop SpaceX under a mural in downtown Brownsville. The outgoing Brownsville mayor, Trey Mendez, posted a photo of you on his social media thanking the police for your arrest. He also wrote, quote, Ms. Hinojosa has been quoted in several anti-SpaceX articles. Can you talk about the former mayor Mendez's ties to SpaceX and how local officials have come after environmental and community advocates like you over opposition to SpaceX? You're still fighting these charges?
You know, I'm still dealing, fighting to have this charge dropped against me. You know, SpaceX is growing into our community. SpaceX is and Elon Musk are actively handing out you know, money here and there, and it's becoming political hush money. You know, it's buying out politicians. We've seen when a SpaceX testing goes wrong, which it always goes wrong and burns down wildlife refuge, you know, political officials just turning the other way. And, you know, I've been personally impacted now by, you know, SpaceX buying out community members, buying out politicians when, you know, last year, four police broke into my apartment. When I asked for a warrant and tried to put on my shoes, they threatened me with resisting arrest. You know, they jailed me for 26 hours. And then I come to find out once I'm released that Mayor Trey Mendez, who's still in office, you know, for the next month, has doxed me. You know, he posted my mugshot on his official Facebook
page. He's the current mayor.
He is the current mayor. His term ends in May. He's chosen not to run for re-election. And I've come to find that the mayor has doxed me. He published my mugshot on his official Facebook platform. He posted my job, trying to get me fired. You know, he singled me out and targeted me because I've been publicly, I've been speaking up about the dangers of SpaceX for years. And what this means is that, you know, the city is signaling to us that, you know, any community organizer speaking up could be next. They're targeting community activists, and we are actively rallying and pressuring the city to investigate Mayor Mendez for abuse of power. You know, we won't tolerate elected officials singling out and targeting and doxing community members. You know, the city is signaling to us that they're selling out to a private space industry.
Talk about how the environment has been impacted. For people who are watching TV to see the SpaceX launch, you see in the upper left Boca Chica. Talk about Boca Chica, where the fresh waters of the Rio Grande trickle into the Gulf of Mexico, the beaches and protected lands such as the lower Rio Grande Valley National Wildlife Refuge near SpaceX.
Yeah, I want to make it clear that Boca Chica Beach was never for sale. You know, Elon Musk has come and colonized our region. You know, Boca Chica Beach is, you know, part of a state park. It's part of near the lower Rio Grande Valley Wildlife Refuge. It's part of an international wildlife corridor that's very important for, you know, species to migrate for genetic diversity. Boca Chica Beach and the entire region is also sacred lands of the Carrizoco Mocurudo tribe. And, you know, families have been going there for generations to fish. Boca Chica Beach is considered the poor people's beach because it's for local people that go, don't have to pay fees to enter, and can go fish to feed their families. It's also where the Carrizoco Mocurudo tribe hold their sacred ceremonies. And Elon Musk and SpaceX have been using their private police force and the local police to turn people away. So he can host his press conferences and parties and test dangerous rocket equipment. You know, that's what we've been seeing. You know, some of the routine testing has caused, you know, over 60 acres of the wildlife refuge to burn down, has sparked grass fires. You know, we've seen threats and deaths of migratory birds and endangered species like the ocelot.
I also wanted to ask you about this point that we raised in the lead as well, and that is last year the Federal Aviation Administration determined that SpaceX's plans for orbital launches would have no significant impact on the Gulf Coast region. The FAA's ruling came after SpaceX founder Elon Musk accused the agency of having a fundamentally broken regulatory structure after it didn't rapidly approve an early Starship test flight. The FAA has also reportedly faced pressure from major SpaceX contractors, including NASA, Pentagon, and the National Reconnaissance Office, all of whom rely heavily on SpaceX to launch satellites and astronauts to orbit and beyond. NASA selected, for example, a version of SpaceX's Starship as a lander for its upcoming Artemis 3 mission, which aims to return astronauts to the moon for the first time in half a century. So they're using this private company for the Pentagon, for the FAA, for all of this NASA work.
No, it's very clear that Elon Musk and SpaceX has become, you know, is becoming too big to hold accountable, you know, and is getting away with harming our community. And, you know, what we need are, you know, real solutions. We need investments, you know, in Earth, the problems we have here on the planet, climate change. And instead, we see our tax subsidies go towards a billionaire's pet project for a billionaire to go, you know, to space as part of his sci-fi adventure.
I wanted to finally ask you about the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission approving the Rio Grande LNG, Texas LNG, you know, liquid natural gas, and the Rio Bravo pipeline Thursday, just hours after the SpaceX explosion. These projects are within a few miles from SpaceX and have faced fierce opposition from groups like yours. Talk about what's at stake and with these projects, especially in the Rio Grande and the Gulf of Mexico's area of the country that are in the front lines of the climate crisis.
Yeah, we're dealing with layers and layers of environmental disasters here in the Rio Grande Valley. You know, communities, I've been fighting back to stop these LNG terminals for nearly a decade. Rio Grande LNG, Texas LNG, and the Rio Bravo pipeline plan to build, you know, next door to SpaceX within 6 miles. You know, and we're terrified of the very real threat that exploding rockets next to giant tanks of gas, next to giant tankers of gas, where we've already seen, you know, rocket shrapnel raining even further past 6 miles. And we're being left in the dark. We haven't heard from regulatory agencies about the flammable risks. You know, and communities here have made it absolutely clear that we oppose these LNG export terminals. All of our communities have passed anti-LNG resolutions, Port Isabel, South Padre Island, Laguna Vista, Long Island Village, you know, because of, you know, the threat of flammable explosion from SpaceX, because this would completely destroy our way of life. We are one of the last little pieces of the South Texas coastline that doesn't have refineries or flare stacks. And, you know, LNG would completely change our way of life for the worse.
Well, Becca Hinojosa, I want to thank you for being with us, environmental and community advocate with the Grassroots Collaborative, Another Gulf is Possible. Coming up, we go to Yemen, a leading human rights activist there, where at least 79 people died this week in a stampede. He'll talk about his country being devastated by the U.S.-backed Saudi war. Stay with us. Morning, Manya, by Azimuth. It was announced this week that Ivan Mamal Conti, the founding drummer of Brazilian jazz funk greats Azimuth, has passed away. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Yemen, where at least 79 people were killed, over 300 injured in a stampede Wednesday, as residents of the capital Sana'a gathered at a school where local merchants were giving away charitable donations to mark the end of Ramadan. Hundreds of people gathered to receive what amounted to about $10. Witnesses told the Associated Press the crowd crush began after armed Houthis fired into the air to control the crowd, striking electrical equipment and causing it to explode. The tragic deaths come as Yemen continues to face one of the world's largest humanitarian crises following years of fighting between U.S.-backed Saudi forces and Houthi rebels. While a ceasefire began a year ago, no agreement has been reached yet on making it permanent. Earlier this month, envoys from Saudi Arabia and Oman visited Sana'a for talks with the Houthis. This came weeks after China helped broker a deal to reestablish diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Saudi Arabia also recently exchanged more than 800 prisoners of war with Houthis in the largest prisoner exchange since 2020. We're joined now by Ali Jamil, the Accountability and Redress Director of Matana for Human Rights, a group that's based in Yemen. He's visiting New York, where he's joining us from now. Ali, thanks so much for joining us. Can you talk about what happened this week, but then put it into the larger context of the devastation of Yemen?
Thank you very much. What we are doing now currently is investigating into this incident in which at least 78 people died in a charity event. But this event shows us a snapshot that illustrates the situation of starvation in Yemen. Hundreds of people were going to death to get donations of nearly $10. Muatana for Human Rights have worked on the use of starvation as a method of war and have made significant investigations for a year long into the conduct and the attacks of different warring parties that led to starvation.
So
our report, The Starvation Makers, looks into the attacks that has been done by the Saudi UAE-led coalition and also the conduct of the Houthi armed non-governmental armed forces that really impacted the food and water security of civilians in Yemen.
Can you talk, Ali Jamil, about this rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran? What kind of effect this will have?
There isn't enough information available about the deal, but we're not even sure if this will impact the war in Yemen and to what extent it will have an impact. But what is clear is that there is also talks between Saudis and Houthis, and the Saudi ambassador to Yemen was in Sana'a in a couple of weeks ago. And there have been also detainees swapped for over 800 detainees. We see this as good steps in terms of building trust among warring parties and could have a good potential of reaching a peace deal, but this is not all what civilians want. It is very important for this war to end, but it's also very important to have accountability, justice, transitional justice, reparations. Yemen has a long history of armed conflicts that happened in the 60s, 80s, 90s, 2003, seven wars in Saada. All of these were ended in a political agreement that didn't have any accountability aspect. And because there is no accountability, no transitional justice, each conflict was just basically a seed for another conflict. And looking into the conflict today, it's clear how much it has an impact from prior conflict. So this violence cycle should be broken, and it will never be broken without transitional justice, accountability, and redress and reparations.
You know, there is a lot being made now, as it should be, of war crimes when it comes to what's happening in Ukraine. But Mwatana, for Human Rights, your group, has said war crimes are and have been committed at the highest level in Yemen. Can you talk about the parties responsible and what these grave crimes are that you have investigated?
Mwatana for Human Rights has a very big team, over 100 team members all over Yemen. We have almost a researcher and a lawyer in each Yemeni governorate. We investigate cases of violations of international humanitarian law, international law of human rights. We have until now documented over 8,000 cases of human rights abuses committed by all warring parties in Yemen. I can say that there is no warring party in Yemen better than the other one. All warring parties in Yemen has been committing horrific violations of human rights that may amount to war crimes. We have documented over 1,000 cases of airstrikes, also land chilling, landmines, child recruitment, arbitrary detention, enforced disappearance, torture, attacks on schools, on hospitals, and a very wide range of other violations that has been committed by all warring parties in Yemen. We used to have in Yemen an independent mechanism formed by the UN, specifically by the Human Rights Council, called the Group of Eminent Experts, that it was the only independent mechanism that investigate in these violations. Unfortunately, in 2021, the Saudis just put all of the sticks and carrots to terminate the mandate of this investigative body, and currently Yemen doesn't have any UN or international investigative body to investigate on those crimes. And this didn't only stop the investigations and the reporting on the violations of Saudis, but it stopped all the reporting and violations on Saudis, Houthis, STC, and other warring parties in Yemen.
And finally, how will a peace process move forward that you think could stick, that you think would hold all sides accountable, Ali?
Yeah. Any peace that doesn't has accountability, transitional justice, reparations, truth-telling, is just a political agreement that can fall at any time. If we're really looking into a long-lasting, durable peace, we should really take the issues of accountability, transitional justice, also reparations to victims and truth-telling into considerations.
Ali Jamil, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Yemeni human rights advocate and accountability and redress director of Mwatana for Human Rights, visiting New York City from Sana'a, Yemen. That does it for our show. I'm speaking at two events this weekend. On Saturday, on April 22nd in Troy, New York, at a celebration of the Sanctuary for Independent Media, 7 p.m. And on Sunday, I'll be in Boston giving the 10th Annual Dorothy Day Lecture at Emmanuel College at 1 p.m. For all details, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Pels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maritia Sena, Tammy Warren, Afterina Ndura, Sam Alkofte, Marie Asti, Juju, Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud, Sanji Lopez, Dennis Moynihan. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Follow us on social media at CJSF on Twitter, on Facebook and Instagram at CJSF Radio. Listen to old episodes and special programming on our SoundCloud at CJSF 90.1. Diverse, independent, and yours.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse, independent, yours.